We're going to switch gears a little bit to the important topic of the environment. I'm going to introduce Shannon Lloyd, who's a senior environmental specialist at First Environment Incorporated in D.C. She's going to talk about capturing the environmental benefits of nanotechnology. She's a Ph.D. in engineering and public policy from Carnegie Mellon, has studied the life cycle of some of the new technologies. Currently working for USDA and Iowa State University on life cycle models of bio-based products. So welcome, Shannon.
Thank you. Well, first I'd like to thank the Foresight Nanotech Institute for giving me this opportunity to speak about some of the work that I did while at Carnegie Mellon University and the work that I'm continuing to pursue at First Environment. A little bit about First Environment. We're an environmental consulting firm of about 50 or so people. We do a lot of work in site remediation. And over the company was founded in the 70s. Over the last 5 years, First Environment has made an effort to get more involved in areas that are more proactive, thinking more long-term, such as using life cycle assessment to evaluate products and technologies, work in the greenhouse gas verification area, and also in establishing environmental management systems for companies. My area of expertise is life cycle assessment. In particular, I like to apply life cycle assessment in the area where you're looking at future products instead of ones that are already out there, so that you can use the findings to help guide research and development. Rather than just making the choice over which product do I purchase now. With that, if you look through the literature or the popular media on nanotechnology, it becomes pretty easy to become overwhelmed by the different types of environmental benefits that are listed and the different types of potential harm. So these are some of the examples that you'll see in the literature and in the public literature on what the potential environmental benefits are. These are ones that are most often cited, ones that have the most broad impacts. So, for example, if we were able to improve the ability to detect and eliminate pollution, that of course would have a large benefit on air, water, and soil quality. I guess some of the ones too that are most widely cited also include reducing energy from product use. And also reducing waste from having more control over manufacturing processes. And of course, the potential harm that gets discussed the most is looking at potential toxicity to humans and ecosystems. But there are a lot of other potential things that may make a product less desirable. So for example, if you need a lot of energy to produce this highly precise product, that might potentially reduce the environmental benefit associated with that product. So then we come to the question, well, how do we compare these benefits and potential harms, and what's the net impact? In terms of comparing and contrasting trade-offs, that's not necessarily a new thing. Some of the potential impacts and benefits from nanotechnology might be new. So from a life cycle assessment perspective, what we like to think about is, one, how do we learn from the life cycle assessments that have gone on since the 70s, and use that approach to evaluate nanotechnology, but also how do we incorporate any potential new benefits or impacts into that life cycle assessment framework? So just to give you a little bit of a background on what life cycle assessment is, it's essentially a systematic approach for looking at the product life cycle. So you look at the entire life cycle, starting from raw material acquisition, obtaining the minerals, the fuel sources that will be used in producing a product. And then, of course, producing that product, and then using it, and then looking at how it will be dealt with at the end of its useful life, whether it be reused, recycled, remanufactured, disposed of, and what the implications of those stages of the product life cycle are. What life cycle assessment does is it looks at this big picture, and it says, okay, what are the inputs and outputs associated with that entire product life cycle? So, for example, you'd look at the material and energy inputs associated with acquiring the raw materials, producing the product, using it, and dealing with at the end of life, but also quantify the various types of releases, what the products that you're producing are, any potential co-products and how they might be used in a useful way, and any other type of waste that's produced in the product lifecycle. It looks pretty concise when you look at this diagram because we have several broad categories included on the diagram, but actually in each one of those you may have hundreds of items that you're quantifying. So for example, airborne emissions, you would be looking at the entire list of pollutants that we're interested in, CO2, NOx, and so on. So hundreds of items. But what life cycle assessment then does is allows you to take all of this information and put it together into what are called impact categories to evaluate the trade-offs between different products or technologies. In the U.S., there is one impact methodology that is the most generally accepted. It's developed by the U.S. EPA. It's called TRACE. It stands for Tool for the Reduction of Chemical Impact. I can't remember what the third letter stands for. But these are the items that they look at. And basically, all of the information from that product lifecycle assessment is combined into the impact categories that are deemed the most important to look at. And this is basically done by using models that reflect the mechanisms from, for example, air releases to global warming, and taking those mechanisms, quantifying them, and modeling them so that you can combine that information into several impact categories that are more manageable and more easy to understand. So going back to nanotechnology, over the last few years, there's been a growing interest in looking at nanotechnology from a life cycle perspective. I started my research at Carnegie Mellon in this area in the late 90s and conducted several studies. By early 2000, I guess, actually, several government agencies were interested in using a life cycle perspective. But in the last few years, there have been several reports that have essentially called for a life cycle perspective in evaluating future nanotechnology-based products. And the quote that I like the most, I think, from these reports is one from the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering in the UK. Essentially, they recommended a series of life cycle assessments to evaluate application and product groups. And in particular, they were looking at nanomaterials and to ensure that the savings in resource consumption during the use of the product are not offset by the increased consumption during manufacture and disposal. The thing that I like about this is that they're emphasizing the need to evaluate the trade-offs, because in comparing products, we are going to have trade-offs that must be evaluated. You're not typically going to find one product that is a winner across all of the impact categories. And so that's the important thing, is that you're evaluating the trade-offs between the products. The one thing that I don't like about it is that I don't think that we can necessarily assume that there will be savings in resource consumption during product use, and we can't necessarily assume that there may be increased consumption during manufacture and disposal. I think that that's going to depend on the specific application, and I think it's going to vary from application to application. This is an overview of the framework that that I use in my research. One thing to point out here is that while working at Carnegie Mellon, we didn't only focus on the environmental implications. We also looked at a life cycle economic assessment, looking at the life cycle cost of these products, but also doing a technology assessment to evaluate what the technology would actually look like for using expert forecasting. And if that technology really was something that was likely to be adopted, commercialized and adopted on a wide scale. So essentially, depending on the stage in which the research and development is, we may be able to use information from actual products, or we may need to rely on the expert judgment of scientists and engineers working in that area. These are a list of the two studies that we deployed life cycle assessment to evaluate two nanotechnology-based applications. The first one was looking at using a couple of different nanocomposites in body panels of automobiles to lighten the automobile and essentially reduce fuel consumption. The second one was using nanofabrication to have better control and stabilization over the platinum group metal particles in automotive catalysts. And in both of these case studies, we worked with scientists and engineers working in these areas with automotive companies or at universities, and worked with them to identify what the performance of these products might be. And then we use that information to conduct a life cycle assessment. And these are just some results, sample results, but to show you a way in which we approach the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty in the technology and forecasting what a technology might look like. This one is one with the vehicle application. And so the horizontal axis is time, vertical is CO2 emissions in million metric tons. The blue boxes that you see going above zero are if you were to assume that vehicles would have the same mix that they do today in terms of the material that their bodies are made out of. So if they were steel, so essentially CO2 emissions would increase with increased numbers of vehicles. The other ones include aluminum, some composites that are currently used, a few nanocomposites. And the thing to point out here is that, and this is assuming that starting in 2005, the material would be substituted for steel. And this was based on what the experts in the field who we were working with, the engineers and the scientists, predicted the most likely performance of these materials. So, of course, this doesn't take into account that there would be an evolution. It just assumes that, okay, we achieve this most likely performance and we start to substitute it for steel in the automobiles. But the thing to point out here is that the white triangle, second down from the bottom, if you look on the far right, is aluminum. Below that are two nanocomposites, above that are two nanocomposites. So what we found in this study is that there is a material out there that is likely to perform just as well as some of these new materials that R&D is going into for these particular applications, but it's not being deployed. And so that had some ramifications for the technology assessment and evaluating whether or not the nanocomposites would be substituted in this application. But also the other thing to point out is that it shows that just because it's nanotechnology, as in that the Royal Society report, use phase may not result in CO2 or use phase reductions. This is the another example of a way in which we presented results. And this one is looking at best case performance. And this one, the reason I show this one is just to show the great uncertainty. But the one thing that we can do is we can look at bounds. So we can look at lower and upper bound performance based on what we're currently achieving and what we identify as best case performance. And this was based on theoretical models to estimate best case performance. And this is looking at platinum group metal usage in automotive catalysts and basically reducing all the agglomeration during vehicle use so that you have a fully effective catalyst to reduce emissions. And what you see, we actually use two different environmental impact models to evaluate energy use. And the two lines, the blue is one model and the purple is the other. The two lines in the middle are basically current performance. The one up above is using current technology to meet new emission standards. And then the one at the bottom was a best case scenario, assuming that we were able to create a fully efficient catalyst. So the thing that this really shows is that there's a lot of uncertainty. We ran the model, again, looking at expected performance. And of course, that uncertainty is much lower. At this point, there's just been a few other nanotechnology LCAs conducted. The ones that are presented here. These were all presented. These, as well as the ones that I've conducted at this point, were all publicly funded. And one of the problems with that is it's difficult to get information about manufacturing from publicly available information. And to summarize, the studies conducted to date, there have only been a few. There's been a little emphasis on the total direct and indirect environmental implications. Based on the fact that there have only been a few life cycle studies. The studies that have been conducted to date, including the ones that I did, there's a detailed analysis of use or material acquisition. However, there's limited processing, fabrication, and end-of-life information included in that. We had to make a lot of assumptions based on current technologies and current production processes. And also another issue with these studies is that at this point, there's only a qualitative discussion about any sort of engineered nanoparticle releases in any of the studies that have been conducted to date because we don't really have a lot of information about that or about what the implications of that might be. A summary of some of the findings. One, there's high potential energy savings from reducing use phase energy consumption or in product material consumption, but not in all cases. So it's going to vary on a case-by-case basis. So use of nanotechnology does not necessarily result in environmental savings. And also, the environmental implications of the other life cycle stages, besides use and in product material consumption, are not clear at this point. So in my mind, the next steps for using life cycle assessment to evaluate nanotechnology from a public perspective are, one, to start trying to quantify the environmental impacts of producing nanostructures. One of the things that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory has done over the last few years is to create a U.S. life cycle inventory database. And what this is it's publicly available information about the life cycle impacts of producing commonly used materials, different types of energy. And what's not there at this point is any information about nanostructures. And of course, once we start to see meeting those market levels of 2015, this is information that that we would like to see in the US LCI database. Also, one of the other things that life cycle assessment relies on is information from risk assessment. So for example, the risk of various pollutants to human health, ecotoxicity. So as information about the fate, transport, and toxicity of nanoparticles becomes available, the life cycle assessment community will have to do a very good job of quickly incorporating that information into life cycle assessment methodology so that we can actually evaluate and the trade-offs associated with any impacts from any type of nanoparticle toxicity. And then third, from a public perspective, another thing that I think needs to be done is we need to look at ways for managing data about nanoparticle releases, because up to this point, we've quantified everything based on mass. So the more that you release, the more harm is the general assumption. But if we have nanoparticles and that the impact on human health may rely more than on other things other than mass, so for example, size, structure, or any other types of characteristics of the nanoparticle, that information isn't readily incorporated into life cycle assessment at this point in time. And so as a community, we need to develop a way in which we can characterize information other than mass within the life cycle assessment framework. From a private perspective, the next steps would be to start using life cycle assessment to evaluate research and development decisions so that you're not evaluating the product after it's developed, but perhaps evaluating different approaches within the research and development phase for example, synthesizing carbon nanotubes, and evaluate which approaches would be most beneficial from an environmental perspective. That wraps up my comments on using life cycle assessment to inform nanotechnology research and development. Here's my contact information if you have any questions or comments, or if you know of an interesting application within the nanotechnology area to apply this framework. I would appreciate any emails. And with that, I'd like to take a few questions. Does anyone have a question?
How are they dealing with or addressing these issues
at this point? It's very small. I mean, there's just a handful of people both in Europe and in the U.S. that are starting to look at nanotechnology. One of the people who's done a lot of work is Barbara Karn at the U.S. EPA to try to include life cycle assessment and other industrial ecology techniques in evaluating nanotechnology. So it's new interest. There aren't a lot of people doing LCA who have any sort of background in nanotechnology, and that's very necessary, and I think, in this field, because it introduces a lot of different issues that LCA hasn't had to deal with. So it's pretty young at this point.
Thanks. I was wondering, you made a good point about mass not being a good metric for quantifying releases. And it seems to me that the thing that you want is some way of quantifying risk in some sense. And, of course, it's missing generally from life cycle and emissions emissions impacts, right? You see newspaper clippings saying 300,000 tons of this versus a couple hundred tons of that. But the 100 tons might be 20 times as toxic as the 300,000 tons.
Right.
Do you have any sense of... And, of course, in nanoparticles, it's a big issue. Right,
that's a good question. And the impact assessment approach, part of life cycle assessment, is taking that information, taking all of these quantities, and translating it into essentially risk or potential impact. And so, you know, that's been something that has been developing over the last 10 years within life cycle assessment, and is continuing to get better at quantifying that risk and putting it in comparable scales for all the different impacts. So that's something that's an issue in the field of life cycle assessment in general, but an area that's been advancing, and a lot more research is going on in that area. But the thing that, and in most risk assessments, you know, the risk is quantified based on mass. You know, you're looking at dose response, and you're looking at how much are you actually exposed to. But this is an area where I think risk assessment and life cycle assessment both are going to have to do a better job of it, saying, okay, maybe how much isn't most important. It's how much and what type and what characteristics. And so I think that's not just an issue for life cycle assessment. That's an issue for both. And as that area improves and more research becomes available, as a life cycle assessment community, we'll have to modify our approach so that we include that information as well.
There's a book, Cradle to Cradle, that looks at manufacturing mm-hmm. from the life cycle perspective. Is there a primer that you would recommend that would be an easy way for us to better understand life cycle so we can combine right. our nanotech understanding
most,
with that?
Most of the books that I've read assume that you have a understanding, a very specific understanding in different areas. But recently there was a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Life Cycle Assessment. And honestly, I thought it was a very easy read. There are sections that most people can breeze through, but it gives you a good overview. But they provide a lot of resources in terms of other books. So if you find an area that you're more interested in, I think that would be a good place to start.